Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We've got good news. The world is open again, and people like you, people of faith, are traveling to Catholic sites around the world. Want to travel with exceptional Catholic leaders this fall, next year, or in the future? Are you looking to see specific sites, celebrate traditional Latin Mass, or travel to destinations without vaccine requirements? We are here to help you deepen your faith on pilgrimage. Give us a call at 1-800-842-4842 or visit us online at selectinternationaltours.com. Select International Tours is your pilgrimage company, and we have the perfect Catholic trip for you.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Here's to good friends.
Cheers.
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 That's sort of an oaky afterbirth.
What was that?
She did tell me to get a beer and some cheese fries over at Eskimo Joe's.
That's very nice, lovely. I only hope you feel this way when I'm done. Because I could destroy this night in 2 seconds.
Why is that funny?
Well, I think it's a bit funny to be trying to define nothing.
Smooth as a bourbon on a summer day. Strong as a peated scotch in the winter night. This is a fair warning. The Catholic Man Show is about to begin.
Slap some bacon on a biscuit and let's go. We're burning daylight.
Welcome to the Catholic Man Show. We're on the Lord's team, the winning side, so raise your glass. Adam Minahan here, sitting in studio. Do we still call it studio?
Yeah.
Sitting in studio with David Niles y Juan Posada, el producer. Jim Jaime is at the door, making sure no one is going to break in. I love how Gail referred to Jim as Jimbo Baggins on Facebook.
I also love that.
Mm-hmm. I like that Jim's real. I was wondering that when he's I came really on. Here. Like, Jim's actually over there. Yeah,
he's
I was right just kind of curious.
He's always right there.
Yeah, I thought Jim was going to be like a volleyball. That was like over there. But everyone was just like, that's our friend Jim.
Jim!
Jim's like a real person.
He is. He is real.
No, I like that.
So, our guest this evening is, he was one of the first guests, I think, of the
one
Catholic
of the earliest,
Man,
yeah.
Yeah, of the Catholic Man Show. Inside 20 episodes.
Yeah.
We have Deacon Harrison. Before this he was
like
a deacon.
This is like a deep track, sort of.
Kind of.
It's a throwback to a deep track.
Yeah.
Sure.
Deacon we'll Harrison
there.
Garlick.
Yeah.
Chancellor of the Diocese of Tulsa in Eastern Oklahoma. A fellow Great Books tutor of the Alcuin Institute for Catholic Culture. Contributing writer for the Catholic Answers magazine and CatholicAnswers.com. I don't know. You have a lot of titles. I think that'll suffice for now.
That's great. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes. New father. A father of a new son, Alfred.
Little Alfred Christian.
So, congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
That's Amy's awesome.
Doing well.
Yeah, Amy's doing well?
Yep.
Good?
Yeah, no, we're very blessed.
Also, a new homeowner.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of things.
You're doing a whole lot of new things.
We have a lot of transitions right now.
Yeah.
I own some new chickens.
New
chicken coop.
I'm like the only non-farmer of the Catholic Mansion. I did not.
Farmer's probably a strong word.
No. You're a farmer now.
You have land.
Yeah.
A pond and chickens in your garage.
I like to go out to Bixby on like Saturday mornings and sit down and get a cup of coffee with some old guys and complain about how terrible the crop was.
In your backyard.
Because I'm a farmer.
In Broken Arrow.
Well, yeah. Actually, last year I did plant wheat.
Oh, nice.
And it didn't grow.
Oh.
My daughters brought home like 2 seeds of wheat, whatever.
Like little wheat berries?
From Catechesis of the Good Shepherd. They were handing them out.
Oh, so you planted those
and
too?
We put them in the garden and nothing happened. And so now I like really can complain. Be like, oh, the wheat crop.
I lost my whole crop last year.
It's terrible.
No, that's good. Okay, I'll claim that. I'm a farmer.
Yeah, and I'm just one of the guys there. Because I'm a farmer.
With a good cup of coffee.
Me and my 5 chickens.
Yeah.
No, that's good.
You have 8 chickens.
I do. Well, they told me a couple would die. And so I was like, well, I don't really want 8 chickens, but I want like 5, so I'll buy 8 chickens.
You know, you can eat them.
You can, yeah. Most of them are egg layers, but yeah, I can't eat them.
Yeah.
I think I'm also allowing my children to name them, so we'll cross
that. That is a mistake, I think.
No, well, if no, I don't think it is. I think you name them and then kill them.
Yeah, you have to actually eat the one that you name.
Yeah, exactly. Make them actually, you do the, like, put right. them in the kill cone and everything.
Yeah, I mean, some of my friends that have animals, they have rules that we're not going to name anything that we're going to eat. Mm-hmm. But then the chickens, I mean, they are dual purpose at certain times, but for most of the time, they're going to be egg layers.
Yeah.
So then you name them and et cetera. And, you know, the kid, also it's weird because you want the kids to pick them up, like when they're chicks, like you want them to be handled, et cetera. So yeah. they're more docile and used uh-huh. to humans. So then it's really hard to, you know, tell them later, like, well, that's just a farm animal, that animal that you cuddled and named and everything, you know. So,
and loved.
Right. So, but it's good. It's we're moving along. We have a lot of transitions, but things are good. We're very blessed.
Good. Okay, so this evening we will have a Talisker Scotch 18 year that Dave brought, which is, I'm really excited. I love Talisker.
The box.
I love the Dark Storm. I love, in fact, that's one of my favorite.
I agree.
Like, it's super underrated. People yeah. don't know about like how delicious it really is.
Yeah.
For $100, I would choose that over Laphroaig Lore, which is
definitely. I mean, but I would take Laphroaig 10 over Laphroaig Lore personally.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure, but I don't know. I'd need to do a side-by-side on that, but...
I think that's just because, like, to me, Laphroaig 10 is... I idolize it a little bit, and so...
You when do.
It's like, oh, this isn't what I love, and so it kind of disappoints me, and I think maybe I don't give it a chance to, like, stand on its own, some of the other Laphroaigs.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of do the same thing with Ardbeg 10, but a lot of the other Ardbegs I'm a big fan of, like the Corrie Vreckan.
Yes. Scorch.
Yeah, I mean, just so I don't know what it is about the
Laphroaig. I just buy Laphroaig 10 every
right.
time.
Yeah.
I think that's actually my greatest contribution to the Man Show, actually.
Yes, you were.
That is true.
You were the one who
I wasn't even on the episode
that
you
on this road.
No, you weren't. You left me to David by myself.
Yeah, I was on vacation, and Dave was like, "It's okay. I'm gonna have Harrison Garlic because you weren't even deacon yet."
Nope.
Have Harrison Garlic on. I'm like, "Perfect. That'll be great." And I remember tuning in on my phone, like live, listening to you guys, and you guys were talking about the diaconate, and then Dave goes, "So why can't women be priests?" You know, it's like that was like one of the first
All right,
questions.
If you're gonna put it that way, I wasn't like asking, you know, like I've been wondering this for a while, you know.
No, I mean, you knew it was a setup question. I mean,
right,
you were throwing a softball to him, and it was an
interview
style question.
I think I just took it as
question.
A statement and moved forward.
Yeah.
Yep, you're right. They can. Yeah.
Next question.
Right. Thank you
well,
so much.
Because they're women. All right.
Yeah. But yeah, we did talk about Laphroaig on that episode.
And that was not our first time. It's not my first time to have Laphroaig. The first time I had it was like a year before. And I remember drinking it and laughing, thinking, that's the worst thing I've ever had.
Right.
Who is it that was out there making whiskey and got this and said, "Stop the press. This is it." Like, make more of this is what we've been searching for. And I just thought it was hilarious that, like, this is, people are out there, like, proud of it. And then a year later, when we tried it on the show, I said, like, that's not bad.
No, it's
good. I like it.
I had I first tried it. I had a friend who had his birthday, had a scotch tasting at mm-hmm. his birthday. And that was, like, the last thing we had. And, like, everyone there hated it. They're like, this tastes like someone took a Sharpie, ground it up, and put it in a bottle. And I kind of liked it. I was like, I can see this. And he told me, actually, he's like, if you start to like this, everything else will taste like a Jolly Rancher.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Like, most everything else, I'm like, gosh, it's so sweet. It's like, no, you're used to drinking something that sounds like a coal mine.
Yeah. Right? I think that's also why I like 6 and 8 year scotches, too, because often they're just a little less refined. A little, you know, they're like rougher around the edges. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of when you're used to, like, that level of intensity that Laphroaig 10 brings to the table.
Right.
Some of those younger scotches kind of imitate that in their own way. So, but this today...
We're on the Lord's team.
Yeah. The winning side.
So raise your glass.
And cheers to Jesus.
Cheers.
So today we're drinking, as Adam mentioned, Talisker 18. This was $145 at the local liquor store here in Tulsa, America.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fantastic.
I do too. I think it actually is worth $140.
I do too. And
what do you think?
It's good.
Yeah, it's good.
It's good.
That's my analysis.
How about the yummy?
It's the top of the yummy scale.
Top of the yummy scale. All right.
All right. Good.
Wow.
That's good. Okay, so Deacon, you're also, like I mentioned, you're the chancellor of the Diocese of Tulsa and Eastern Oklahoma. What the heck is a chancellor? What is that?
That's a good question. So
thank you.
Yeah, well done. So chancellors typically do different things in each diocese. Mm-hmm. So under canon law, we're basically in charge of documents. We are an ecclesial notary, so our job is to keep track of everything, to issue documents, notarize all of the bishops' official documents, make sure everything's...
Do you actually have to do something like that, like a notary does, where you...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you look at Bishop Condola's documents that come out to the diocese, if they have any, if they're out of his actual authority, he's mm-hmm. actually promulgating something as law, or we're going to do this, right? Not like a thank you letter or pastoral letter,
sure.
But this has, weight behind it.
Yeah.
We need to do it here. Then usually my name's on it. I notarize it.
Uh-huh.
So it's usually bishop, and then down in the corner I'll do it. So all priest assignment letters, things like that, et cetera. So a few public ones that come out, if he names a certain year or something like that. But that's a lot of my job is keeping track of that. That's actually his signature. Who's actually making sure, this pipeline, as Adam knows from communications director, because he's constantly asking us, what is this document actually going to come out?
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it's like herding cats to figure out where is the document right now in the pipeline and who needs to see it before it comes out. So that's a lot of...
It's secret.
Right.
It's secret.
Yeah. There's, there's just things that, for the sake of...
No, it is. It's just funny because I've still been... in fact, I've been working at the chancellery now for a year. This is...
That's weird to me. I feel like you just started.
Just started. I know. So I'm about a year in. And it's just funny how I have learned the different things of the various ticks of the chancellery, things that have to go through certain pipelines. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, so under canon law, that's what chancellors do. Right. And so then after that, it just wildly differs. So a lot...
Because you're also in-house counselor.
Right. So I'm also an attorney, and the diocese is my client, right? So I serve in-house for the diocese. And so usually inside the Anglosphere, chancellor has typically borne some type of weight and authority behind it, mm-hmm. right? And so that's why, for instance, in canon law, there's no such thing as a chancery. It's the curia. It's the bishop's court, right? But in the Anglosphere, we usually talk about a chancery because that's where the chancellor is, right? He's usually the one that's actually there. So inside the United States, chancellors typically are either legal counsel, there's some type of business manager over the whole diocese, or a lot of times they're running HR. So usually it's something that's also document related, someone who kind of naturally fits into that. So I play that role and then generally help out Bishop with the corporate structure of the diocese and then oversee about a dozen chancellery offices.
And you're technically the archdeacon?
No.
I think you are. It's in my phone, I have you as Archdeacon.
Well, then
Harrison.
That's certainly official. Yes. Yeah. What am I in your phone? Yeah, that's good.
Hey, I just want to take a second to thank you, the Catholic Mantra listener, for your support in Christ-Centered Capital. Christ-Centered Capital is a watchdog site for Judeo-Christian investors. If you go to ChristCenteredCapital.com, you can use promo code TCMS2022 and get 1 month free and have access to all of Mark Lozano's investments reports and help support his partner charities. Because we've had so much support in Christ-Centered Capital, Mark continues to grow. He continues to grow his business, and he's having new opportunities to help promote his business. So one of the things he's about to do is be featured on Capturing Christianity with Cameron Bertuzzi talking about Christian investing. So you're not going to want to miss that. Go to ChristCenteredCapital.com. You'll be able to stay up to date with what Mark is going on and more importantly, be able to invest your money in a ethical way. So go to ChristCenteredCapital.com, use promo code TCMS2022 for 1 month free, no obligation, subscription to his access to investment reports and support of his partner charities. ChristCenteredCapital.com, where do your values lie?
And welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles. Here with Adam Minahan, our special guest is the Lord Chancellor himself, Harrison Garlick.
Deacon.
Deacon, oh, I forgot that part.
Yeah.
Mea culpa.
You're forgiven.
Thank you. So I have been looking forward to this episode for a long time. I know that you have agreed to come on to the episode, do this episode with us for a long time. Not necessarily, I don't know if you've been per se looking forward to it.
Yeah,
I think you're a little bit nervous about it.
I am,
but it's going
to
be awesome.
A good conversation with Adam. Yeah.
This is going to be one of those episodes where I think we're going to blow people's mind because we're going to talk about something that they think probably most people think that they like generally know what it is, and I think generally they don't. And I'm one of those people. I generally thought I knew what Eros was or mm-hmm. erotic love until you disabused me of that notion. And
it's a good word.
Thank you. I got that from AJ Hoffland. He used that word time, and I was like, "That is a sweet word."
Yeah, it's used in the legal field a lot.
I try to throw it in when I can.
We're always trying to disabuse people of everything.
Right. I also like to use "behold" as often as I can.
Okay.
Just because it's
like
an awesome
angel.
Word. It's like, hey, the other day I was beholding this movie, and you should really check it out.
Okay.
That was one. You got one.
Okay,
you have two. Right. You get two, Dave.
No, that was not an Eros joke. It was not an Eros joke.
All right, so we'll table that.
Okay.
Yeah, so Eros, I think, I think you are right. It's a term that we do need to disabuse, the misunderstandings of. It's a word that we need to reclaim, I think, as Catholics, mm-hmm. right? Because I think it has a much deeper meaning than the more kind of like shallow, vapid way it's been read in modernity.
Yeah.
So I think, broadly speaking, if we're going to have a working definition that we start to kind of play out, Eros... erotic love, it really is a need to be satiated, right? All humans by our nature have a need love, right? So a love that has to actually be satiated. We long to feel complete, to feel whole, right? And I think that, you know, obviously like in today's culture, most of us immediately associate that with sexuality, right? Mm-hmm. With sex. And that's not actually too terribly wrong. I would say it's more of a starting point than actually like the completion of it, right?
Uh-huh.
So Eros, like most people, if you talk about Eros, it's a Greek term. Most people turn to Plato's Symposium because that's the subject is Eros. And actually, you know, the men there are discussing Eros after one of the poets has had a victory in a contest. And so they're going to all talk about Eros. And they're talking about Eros the god, which so that's another thing is that Eros also refers to a god. A Greek god. His Roman name is Cupid. But through the Renaissance, Cupid became this kind of cherubim / fat little baby. And so...
More stupid. Do stupid Cupid.
It seems more shallow again, right? It's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, we have that. It's a, you know, Valentine's Day kind of deal.
Right.
You know, just speaking of things that we've gutted of meaning. And so, you know, when they talk about in the Symposium, they give all these, like, praises of the god Eros and what this means and et cetera. And it's really fascinating. And there's a lot of things to dig into there. But then, of course, Socrates has to speak. And like every time when he speaks, he's going to bring clarity to this. And it's a really fascinating dialogue because it's one of the very few times that he actually says, well, actually, I didn't know anything about this. And here's who I learned it from when I was younger, which is rare for him. I think he only does that one other time. And the other thing that's very odd is that he refers to a woman, that a woman taught him what he refers to as his erotics, mm-hmm. right? So a certain way you're like, oh, here we go, right? Here comes sexuality. And her name's Diotima. And what she teaches him is like, yeah, there is a seeking of a wholeness to be satiated. And in that satiation, when we actually feel complete and whole, there's happiness. And Eros ultimately terminates in happiness, right? We all have this desire for happiness. And it does actually start with the beloved, right? The lover looks on the beloved. And even on a shallow level, right, there's the contours of the beloved. There's the body of the beloved. There's these things that we find arousing, and we're lured to it. You see this like in our culture, right? Often in a corrupted way, but like we're drawn towards beauty, and particularly mm-hmm. we're drawn towards beautiful people, right? And we see this in our art. We see this all around us. We see this in the ways we communicate. You know, these kind of things. And so, but what Diotima teaches him is that Eros is not reducible to that love of the beloved, right? So like if we're going to look at this. She says that's the problem is that when you satiate in the beloved, when you actually, so I mean, sexuality is certainly a part of this, right? There's a coming together. But the problem is that we as humans want to be happy all the time. Like we don't want to be happy some of the time. We want to be happy all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And so your beloved is finite, but your satiation, your thirst, right? To be sated, your erotic thirst is infinite. Because you want to be happy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Diotima points out here is that that can't be the end of your erotic love. Because if it was, it's disproportionate. Mm. And you actually, I think there's a huge, as an aside, I think there's a huge thing for why marriages fail, right? It's like, oh, that person completes me, right? Right. We actually put an unfair burden right. on our spouse to make us happy all the time.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, we hang we hang all this weight on a hook that just can't bear the weight.
Exactly. It's not fair, right? And then, of course, like expectations fail and you have divorce and all these things. And so I think that what she teaches him is like, Eros, in a certain way, can be seen as a ladder, right? Or the climbing of a mountain. Eros is actually an ascent. It's a love that actually draws you upward.
Uh-huh.
And so we have this, certainly this love of the beloved. And, you know, it can start on what we might call a shallow level, but I think just a real level of like, what does the beloved look like? The contours of the body? Why am I attracted to this person? But then she says, but what happens is that if there's a maturation of Eros, right, a maturity, you also start to love the person as a person. You start to love that person in their virtue,
mm-hmm.
in their honor, in glory. And all of a sudden, what happens is that it's not just the virtue of that individual person. It's virtue broadly speaking. It's not just honor or glory in that individual. It's honor or glory broadly speaking, right? So she paints this picture of like the poets, the statesmen, these people that are seeking honor and glory, warriors, are actually playing out an erotic appetite. They're seeking something that actually is infinite, right? A good, right? A beauty. And so the poets, the warriors, the statesmen, all these people are actually trying to satiate their erotic appetite on a higher beauty, right? Than just a person.
Right.
And then she goes on. So you kind of see this ladder going up. She goes on to say, but again, all those things in certain ways are finite. And it's really not until you start to satiate, you start to quench your thirst on beauty itself, right? On the infinite. And the only thing that's beauty itself is God.
Mm-hmm.
So in this pagan text, we have this very beautiful picture that there's this ladder, right? And we have to go this. And that, obviously, why Socrates is recounting this is because what that means is the most erotic life is the life of the philosopher. It's the intellectual life, right? And you see that we see all kinds of great saints playing this out of just like they're seeking God. And it's not just an academic exercise. There's actually an existential fulfillment in that, right? When they come to meet him. So, of course, like this is a pagan text. And so, like, okay, what does this have to do with Catholicism and et cetera? And like, you know, we can get pushback against that. And I think the text to turn to, particularly because I don't want anything here to be like, you know, Deacon Garlick's cool ideas. I mean, this is all the wisdom of the church, but I would argue it's the wisdom of the church that we've set aside and forgotten to the detriment of ourselves and our neighbor,
yeah.
right? Because our world is just one giant parade of disordered Eros. And so what ends up happening is Deus Caritas Est by Pope Benedict XVI
mm-hmm.
is a modern text by a modern pope giving a defense of Eros. And so he mentions the symposium, he mentions these things, but he points out, like, this is actually very harmonious with the biblical tradition, right? He says, no, look, I mean, you can look at Adam and Eve, right? Is there a lost wholeness? Is there a seeking of wholeness? You know, it's not as much as, like, the Greek myths where, like, humans were split, if you're familiar with that. Like, at the beginning, like, we were together and humans were split and we're actually looking for the one that we lost, right? It's not necessarily a punishment, but there is a certain thing of Adam seeking Eve and then becoming one flesh, mm-hmm. right? There's a satiation there, a fulfillment, a happiness. But then so in this, when he shows that this is really ingrained in our human nature, but he also points out to like, what about the Old Testament prophets, right? There's some text that we like would feel uncomfortable reading out loud. If you see that actually the entire context between God and Israel, like at Sinai, is a marriage covenant.
Right.
And in Jeremiah, God's just like, you were this naked girl out in a field and were nothing. And I decided to take you as my bride, right? And he even talks about your breasts were fully formed. I mean, God tells Jeremiah like this very erotic description of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
He takes her as his bride. He washes her, right? He fine linens, jewels, right? He takes
the whole
her up.
The whole book of Song of Songs is
yeah. It would be another
basically,
example.
Basically, yeah.
Right. It's also the context by which we understand why God seems to contextualize idolatry as idolatry, right? As adultery, uh-huh. right? And so because there's actually a sin against husband and wife in this,
right?
So Pope Benedict paints this picture, right? As this, there is this deeply erotic tradition. And that God himself has taken our common, what you might call like a common Eros, the love of man and woman, and used it as an analog to explain humanity's relationship with God. And so it's deeply ingrained, I think, in our own spirituality, particularly like throughout the Old Testament and then in the New Testament. it's quite clear because, again, Christ plays this out. He is the groom. Mm-hmm. We are the bride.
Right.
We become one flesh with him, right? He becomes the head. We are the body. That's how we enter into Trinitarian love, is being accepted in his body, right? And what do we see? We see in the Holy Eucharist, we become one flesh with him, right? I mean, there's this deeply erotic strata that runs through Scripture that, whether it's because of like bourgeois morals or Puritanism, we tend to kind of set aside, right? It's just, that's too intense.
Right.
That sounds odd. Like, I don't think sex in my spiritual life should have anything to do. It sounds
impure. I must be interpreting this wrong.
Right. It's like, and I think Song of Solomon, like you said, is a good example of this as well.
Right. I mean, because that's essentially a love song of the church to his, you know, to the bride at the time, right? I mean, it's an Old Testament version of the bridegroom and the bride, but...
At times, which is very explicit.
Right.
Right. But just like Eros itself, Song of Solomon works on multiple levels.
Yeah.
It's a husband and wife, but it's also Christ and his church, it's God and humanity, so it plays out.
Okay. We've got a lot more to say about this.
Good. That was a lot of talking.
So, like, take this break, process, we're going to keep going. We'll be right back.
There's a common thread among thousands of formerly sinful people we now call saints. They had a relationship with God, which then inspired them to set the world on fire, as St. Catherine of Siena put it. But more importantly, and more specifically, it meant they put in the time. They sat with the Lord. They spoke with him. They listened to him. Daily. They unveiled their hearts and wounds and problems to him. They offered him thanks and gratitude. They left their sufferings with him on the altar. They begged for his help. So my question to you is, are you putting in the time? I know that I've sat in front of the church or sat in adoration making this mental grocery list of things that I want. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about time to build a consistent, honest relationship, time to speak, and time to listen. Dave and I have talked about on the show before that if you don't have an adoration hour once a week, are you really taking your faith life seriously? Are you really taking your prayer life seriously? But sometimes you need a guide to help you in this holy hour. And so Exodus 90 has specifically put together a guide for you to help with your holy hour. In the show notes, you'll find a simple breakdown that shows you how to structure your time with the Lord. So this guide is also mobile friendly. If you go to exodus90.com/TCMS, that's TCMS, the Catholic Man Show, exodus90.com/TCMS, you can get a free mobile friendly guide on how to structure your holy hour. Highly recommended. Go check it out. Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. Sitting here drinking a little bit of Talisker 18 year, a delicious scotch.
Which is just getting better.
It really
is.
A
good scotch, it impresses you at first, but then it keeps getting better, right? Mm-hmm. This one is doing that.
Yeah, it is very good. Sitting here talking with Deacon Garlick on the topic of Eros. Deacon, is it odd for us to understand this, especially as men, like this topic of Eros, because it's odd for us as men to interpret the receiving end of things, like, you know, as a, like, we're the bride of Christ, so like the idea of this is hard for us to interpret as men being the receiver instead of the giver.
Yeah, I think in a certain way, I think as Catholic spirituality in certain ways is deeply feminine, right? Because we receive this,
and they're just holier women,
right? Yeah,
I mean they are, and
yeah, the highest creature in all creation, yeah. Right? Is right. A woman,
right?
So. Yeah, I think in certain ways, I think in other ways, though, it's just because simply we've lost it, right? St. John of the Cross has a deeply erotic text, right? I mean, how he talks about his spirituality, his relationship with Jesus Christ, et cetera. And he definitely puts himself in a receiving,
yeah,
receptive.
Very receptive, yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes, though, I mean, because of whatever you want to blame our current understanding of these things, which I think there are many, it's a text that sometimes we're deeply troubled with, right? Because we're not used to talking about our spirituality.
I mean, Teresa of Avila, you read some of her stuff.
There's even
in prayer and she's talking about the ecstasy of prayer and you're like, wow, this kind of makes you blush, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, she's another one that if you actually read, you know, because there's that great statue, right, of her actually being stabbed with, you know, by basically an Eros figure, uh-huh. right? This winged figure. She's being stabbed and she's in ecstasy, which Pope Benedict will talk about. There's a deep relationship between.
But it's a little bit scandalous because, mm-hmm. I mean, it looks like she's in like climax almost, you know?
Yeah, well, actually, it's more scandalous if you read her actual text because she talks about, right, moaning. She uh-huh. talks about like, well, it hurt in the beginning and then it was pleasurable, mm-hmm. right? And you're reading this and you're like, I can't read this out loud to people. Like, what's
you're
happening?
You're a nun.
Right, yeah. So again, I think that, you know, there's multiple reasons. I think one is a certain Puritanism that wants to mm-hmm. say, hey, all this, anything to do with erotic love gets yeah. put away. It's actually even just wrong to begin with, right? Sexuality in general is almost like defective. And there's another one, I think, of just like this bourgeois morality of just like, you know what? You're just taking your Catholic life a little too seriously.
Yeah.
Right? You're just taking it too seriously, right? Just do what you got to do, et cetera.
You don't have to be weird about it.
But like comparing yeah. like, you know, your relationship with Christ to like a climax or like whatever, like please just stop, yeah. right? Not necessarily because it's like gross, but because like that can't be real. No one actually has that type of relationship with Christ, right? We've just flattened things.
Well, I have this theory. This is just my own personal theory.
This should be good.
This will be good.
Very little weight, but
Can everybody
juicy?
Just everybody take a second.
Yeah.
Sit down or
get out your paper and pen. But
pour a drink.
The moment when the Holy Spirit overshadowed Mary, that she experienced the most physical pleasure in that moment that any person has ever experienced or will experience in all of existence.
You pull that from anything or just like
no, that's just my own theory because she who was so pure
right.
would have been like there's just something there's like this link between pleasure and like the pleasure's healthy, you know, like ordered pleasure and holiness, sanctification, and it just right. seems to me that that would have been she would have experienced A because she had the capacity to. And because it was fitting and like right, it seems that that would have been a moment of just literally out of this world pleasure for her.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think there's merit to that. I think too, it tethers to you know some of the commentary that notice that as soon as this happens to her, she has to leave. Right, she has to go away. And mm-hmm. She goes to Elizabeth, and so there are commentaries that like she became so radiant and was so beautiful in that that her out of her own humility, she just had to literally get away from other people. Because what she was and what she had just experienced, right, this pure reception of the will of God just so elevated her, even in like a physical way, that she actually had to get away
like a, from other people. Like Moses almost,
yeah,
you know,
very similar to Moses, right?
Huh. Fascinating. I did not know that.
I think there's, Dr. Milosh of the Alcuin Institute likes to, that's kind of a guidepost. I think he likes to mention that when talking about Mary.
Yeah, and we talk about like the pregnant glow sometime. So
yeah, the pregnant glow.
It's like a natural thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So imagine if that's Jesus or God, right? Inside.
And you're perfect.
Right. So
I never thought about that.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of reasons that it's hard today for us to adopt it as Christians. I think one is just simply because we've stopped talking about it. You know, a question that comes up a lot is like, okay, so you can point to these, we might call erotic examples in like the New Testament, right? The reception of the Holy Eucharist, becoming one body with Christ, right? Mm-hmm. The analogs there with the sexual relationship of male and female, right? Becoming one flesh. Mm-hmm. Typically not something that like I would give a homily on, but something that's deeply ingrained in our own spirituality.
Well, even just the correlation of marriage and the Trinity, you know, in the Trinity of the Father has love for the Son receives that love and gives it back.
Mm-hmm.
And that exchange of love is so real that it is the Holy Spirit. In marriage, the husband gives his love to the wife. His wife, she receives it and gives it back. And it's so real that 9 months later, you have to give it a name. You know, like, it's just an analogy, but, you know, that's not an accident.
Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the ways we find pushback here is that I think people say, well, where does the New Testament actually talk about Eros? You know, because it's written in Greek. So where does Eros come up? And the answer is, it doesn't. Right. We have these like examples, right? These analogs, if you will, but we don't actually have like Christ like giving a talk on like erotic love.
Mm-hmm.
And then St. Paul obviously talks about agape all the time. And so I think one of the ways to start to parse this out, and this is Pope Benedict in Deus Caritas Est does this quite well, is that, you know, he starts to kind of play out the tradition on this. Like, well, what do we know as traditions? Is this something that we're just coming up with? Like, what's our own Catholic tradition talk about it, et cetera? Because there's a lot of Protestant scholarship that places agape and eros as competitive, right? So there's this Saint,
interesting.
Saint Paul gave us agape love, this self-sacrificial love, you know, this love like Jesus. And here's pagan Plato, right? And they gave us a need love and a love that has to be satiated, a love that takes.
It's a self-love.
Yeah. And it's like, well, see, this is all bad. And so you have to have this self of love. Pick up your cross and follow Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, there's famous scholarship in a lot of different areas from the Protestant circles. And that goes back to them basically rejecting the entire Hellenized tradition and predicating a lot of their biblical interpretation on a myth that doesn't exist. And so part of the things that gets jettisoned with, oh, the Greeks are bad, right? There's a pure biblical Hebrew faith apart from a Hellenized culture was Eros.
Mm.
So it gets pushed out against pretty clearly. And unfortunately, as Catholics, I think we've actually adopted a lot of their presuppositions to do that, right? Because, I mean, you'll hear Catholics talk about, like, yeah, there's agape love that's like God's love, and then there's Eros, and that's like a negative love. That's like a selfish love.
Mm.
And Pope Benedict points out, like, okay, the Protestants say it's competitive. There's also a good argument that there's no distinction between the two. So, you know, because you have the Greek fathers, and sometimes they use Eros for all the loves, like for everything, right? They'll talk about St. Paul in Eros. They'll talk about God as Eros. They'll go so far as to talk about Christ being like Eros, the God, and having a bow and arrow and shooting people, right, to love him, right, when providence calls you to him.
And in English, the fact that Eros and shooting arrows, that's just a coincidence.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really
I don't think the etymology there lines up. I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
Okay.
So, you know, one is that, listen, there's two different cultures here. There's the Greek culture that really started to use Eros. The Latins then, like, so if you read, like, St. Augustine, who has a deeply erotic text, right, talking about all these things he struggled with,
sure,
and et cetera. And it, by the way, I think a proper reading of the Confessions is that you see him discovering the ladder of erotic love.
Yeah, and moving up the ladder.
Moving upward, right? So he actually, but he's writing in Latin, so he talks about amor, right? So one of the problems is that, you know, the Western tradition starts using a different word. The Greek tradition's using Eros for almost everything because they're adopting a Neoplatonic mindset. And then the medievals go straight Latin. And so it's like, what word are they using there? So one camp is just like, it's all intermingled, right? And so like, they're not competitive, but they're also not distinct. Pope Benedict, I think, pulling from a very sound tradition, says, at least for pedagogical reasons, we can look at them as two different movements of the soul. So Eros is an ascent. Eros draws you upward. It is God calling you. So, you know, we hear that divine voice, the true beloved, right? Our actual beloved. And he calls us through many things. It might be the beauty of a woman. And that's something, again, that's very foreign to us, right?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that a little bit, like parse that out a little bit, because I think that is so foreign to us, the idea of the beauty of a woman bringing us closer to Christ.
I think it happens all the time. Go to your nearest RCIA class and ask how many men, it's like, why are you joining the church? Well, I'm getting married and my wife's Catholic. It happens all the time.
Yeah, but that's not that's an
I know it's not exactly what you're talking about.
Right. But. No, but I mean, I think you could parse, there's something deeper going on there, right? Of why would that man concede so much to this woman, right?
And take on a lot. I mean, the Catholic Church is not,
faith.
You know, that's... Yeah, it's not like changing gyms or something, you know?
Hopefully not. So I think that, well, I think there's a lot of talking about the beauty of a woman and how does that lead us to God. I think that, you know, we have several texts that talk about this. So we already talked about the pagan side. You have the Symposium, which makes this argument explicitly that as you love someone, it might start off very artificially. I don't mean that necessarily as a pejorative, but then you come to know them as a person. You come
just
to know
the exterior. You see their physical beauty. Right.
Which, I mean, you know, even Thomas says, like, okay, that's all accidents, right? But accidents add much.
Sure.
Right? I mean, they add much. Right? So there's a reason that you were attracted to your wife, et cetera. So I think that what we see is there's a natural thing that we know this. Think of how many times even wisdom itself, so wisdom brings us to God, is personified as a woman, right? So we see this in the Old Testament wisdom literature, right? So wisdom is created by God. She's there with God. She helps God create this. The Old Testament writers are pining after her, right?
Yeah.
And then probably the most famous example in poetry is Dante's following after Beatrice.
There it is.
Right? Dante follows after Beatrice through hell.
Yeah.
Why? For the love and beauty of a woman. And he has to mature to take that beauty from her to then satiate in beauty itself.
Okay. Got one more segment. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Adam Minahan, and this is David Niles from the Catholic Man Show.
And we are so excited because we are going on pilgrimage to Ireland. We're going this September, September 15th through the 24th. We're going to go to some amazing Catholic places in the country. As you know, the Catholic tradition in Ireland is so deep and rich. And while we're there, we're also going to be visiting some distilleries, if you can even imagine that, you know. Us, the Catholic Man Show. So we're going on basically a cathedral and distillery pilgrimage to Ireland. It's going to be awesome.
And because we're going on a distillery tours that are not typical for the tourist, Dave, we're not taking a bunch of people. We're not taking 60 people. We're not taking 50 people. We're capping this off at 30 people because we want to be able to We want it to be intimate. We want it to be able to go to places that normal tourists don't get a chance to go to. Go to selectinternationaltours.com/Catholic Man Show for more information.
Welcome back to the Catholic Man Show. I'm David Niles here with Adam Minahan and Archdeacon Harrison Garlick. We're talking about Eros.
Okay. We haven't even made Jim blush once.
I know. Well, that's because, you know, like, Harrison is also really a pretty good target. Like, when it comes to, like, you know, calling you Archdeacon or Lord Chancellor, like, you let it get to you. And, like, that's why we keep doing it, I think. I mean, just...
I enjoy that Juan's put that on the title for the show. That's great.
Look at that.
Yeah, Archdeacon.
So, like, as a big brother, let me just tell you. Whenever my little brothers and sisters, like, would try to do something to me, even if it, like, killed me inside, they didn't know it.
Yeah, I think at least I have to have some kind of feigned, like, disgust, just in case, like, you know, Bishop watches this on Monday. Actually, Monday's his day off, on Tuesday. And he's like, why'd you have all these people call you Archdeacon? I'm like, did you watch the video? I clearly shook my head. I said, I do not agree with this, or Lord Chancellor, or the 19 other titles I have. I do not do that. Please note, roll the tape.
Right? Roll the tape. Wind it back.
I actually have video proof that I did not agree. So,
Very good.
If you've been listening on the radio or a podcast, go check us out on the stream. We just had a good conversation on Dante in between segments.
Yes.
If you recall, we had a whole episode on hell, I don't know, a few weeks, maybe a month or two ago.
Yeah.
And in that episode, we claimed that we would have Deacon Garlick back on once we finished Dante's Inferno to talk about hell again. And we're actually very close to finishing. This week we'll finish.
Yeah.
Correct.
I'm
excited about.
I got to tell you, I'm thankful to have like the group that we had when reading Dante because I feel absolutely. Like I would have quit halfway through. I feel like that reading it, I've been like, yeah, okay, this is great. I'm not really getting a whole lot out of this. I have other things I want to read.
I do want to get back to Eros because
you know, I know like, you're right. But
this could sidebar the whole segment.
I'm sorry. But like, I appreciate like there's just so much to it that I would not have.
Well, let's segue by the fact that Dante pursues Beatrice, right? He's pursuing a beautiful woman, and it's for that love, right? Divine providence kind of sends him on this journey, particularly through Mary. And now he's pursuing this beautiful woman, and that's really his impetus for going through the Inferno and Purgatory and things like this.
And before we get to this, there's one thing I also have to mention, is that we are going on a pilgrimage to Ireland, which has nothing to do with Eros, except that we're going to be drawn there by our love for Christ to go and pursue him on a pilgrimage, which is, you could call that erotic, the way we're
everything's moving. Erotic.
Yeah, everything is. So... please go and, like, you got to come with us. We're going to, basically, we're going to have Mass at an awesome Catholic place every morning.
Father Sean Donovan
with Father
is going with us.
Sean Donovan, who's excellent, excellent priest. We're going to be going to distillery after distillery.
Holy place after holy place. We're actually
checking out the Catholic sites of Ireland.
We're having a Mass on a Irish rock outside. Traditional Latin Mass celebrated on an Irish rock outside. Should be epic.
It is going to be awesome.
Just like St. Patrick did back in the time.
That's right.
In the day.
Just like St. Patrick.
It was a Wednesday.
Go to Select International
Daily Mass.
Tours. I messed that up. What is it?
Yeah. It's selectinternationaltours.com.
Yeah.
/Catholic Man Show.
Okay.
There it is.
I got it right.
Yeah.
There it is.
Boom. Okay. Eros.
All right. So erotic love. Where were we? Yeah. So there's three ways to look at it. One, they're competitive between agape and eros, right? These two, it's St. Paul's agape versus Plato's pagan eros. I think there's a profound misread that's satiated or saturated in Protestant thinking.
Mm-hmm.
One is that, and then the second one is that simply that they're too conflated, right? The different traditions are using these words interchangeably.
They're just the same.
Yeah, they're just the same. And again, as we
and
said,
in some ways that's true.
In some ways, that is true. Yeah. Yes, that is true. I mean, I think the if you look at Gregory of Nyssa and a lot of the Greek church fathers, they just strictly use eros for everything, right? Eros died upon the cross. Eros, Christ is eros. Christ is, shooting us with arrows. Christ, they use language. Everything's a language of ascent, right? So they'll talk about a ladder. They'll talk about a mountain. They'll talk about us having wings, us being like fire, right? We go up.
Mm-hmm.
He even talks about one image that I found particularly striking of we all have like a chain connected to our soul that is connected to God, and it's climbing those links up and up and up to find, so it's all of this ascent. How do we actually rise in our spirituality, I think. The third kind of way to look at it, following Pope Benedict, is that they're not competitive, but in the midst of them being used in different traditions, we can still parse them out and provide some clarity for pedagogical reasons, that agape, well, that eros is an ascent, right? We move towards God, and that's a natural love. We all have that, right? We all seek to be satiated. We all have a need love. C.S. Lewis, who's decent on this subject in his book, The Four Loves, actually talks about in the intro that he was going to do this. He was going to compare agape, which was good, to eros, which was bad. And he realized in his studies this was incorrect. That need love is actually a good natural love, right? We need to be satiated. We're designed to be fulfilled, to feel whole, things like this, and that can drive us upward towards God. I don't think he has the full view of it. Your boy, Joseph Pieper, actually is quite good on the subject on his essay on love and faith, hope, and love.
To the peepster.
Yeah, he's quite good on this subject, actually.
Most subjects that he takes on, he's quite good.
Yeah, he's very good. So... So anyway, we have this eros that leads us upward. So how does this correspond with agape? Well, agape is basically caritas, right? It's charity. And we know that's a supernatural virtue, right? It's a theological virtue, which means it actually only comes to us by coming to know God, right? We have to have his sanctifying grace. We go through baptism. And then once we receive it, it acts like a habit, right? We have to habituate ourselves to it. So what Pope Benedict does is he says, listen, we have this erotic love, this eros, that leads us up this ladder towards God. But then once we meet him, right, we're actually satiated in him. We find that fulfillment. We find beauty itself. And it's only in throwing myself into beauty itself, into that abyss, that I actually feel whole. Then we can experience agape. We can have, and then agape, in certain ways, is the opposite. It's a selfless love. It's a giving love.
Yeah.
And so you see these two movements of the soul. In certain ways, you see this very clearly in the saints. And this is why you have to understand erotic love, because like we look at like Mother Teresa and we say, oh my gosh, how could she just give and give and give? Like, how does someone give that love and not receive anything back? And we tend to think to ourselves, well, she just doesn't need love in return. And that's actually terribly wrong.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually that she's so saturated in her erotic love for God, which, she's a particular example because of her dark night and things like that, but it's what Providence provided for her.
Right.
She is so saturated in that it overflows, and she can give that agape love freely because she's being satiated on Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And I think you see this in the gospel, and even how we evangelize sometimes is wrong, right? Like if we're going to meet someone that we want to be Catholic, it's like, why should I be Catholic? And you're like, you should pick up your cross and follow Jesus. And you're like, that makes zero sense to me.
Well, that sounds
hard
terrible.
Pass.
Yeah. Right. Like, why? Like, that sucks. Like, why would I do that?
Right.
But Christ, actually, if you pay attention to his words, he says, hey, I have, right, living water. In me, you will never thirst again.
Yeah.
In me, you will never hunger. He actually evangelizes through this satisfaction. You will be sated, right? And it's only in that satiation that then in God, right, in coming to know him, having his sanctifying grace, that agape starts to blossom. And so Pope Benedict then says, listen, if eros leads us upward to God, and then we meet God, and that's where we have agape, and agape is what we can share then with others, right? We kind of, he points it as a descent or descending down to other people. Then, we have this pagan example of the ladder, right? We go up to God. But Pope Benedict says there's this upward movement, and then a downward movement. And he actually points that the perfection of the pagan idea of this ladder of erotic love is perfected in Jacob's ladder, that the angels are moving up and down, and up and down. And this is the spiritual life, right? I am satiated in God. Because even once Eros, right, your erotic love, once you actually do meet God and you have that sanctifying grace, right, it's elevated. It's perfected. And this is what you see in St. John of the Cross. You see it in Teresa of Avila, right, as we discussed. You see it in Gregory of Nyssa is a famous example of this. He uses erotic loves all the time. He's actually writing to a Greek audience, trying to like write on the life of Moses of like, why is Moses actually a great like philosopher or like a great thinker? Well, Moses ascends Mount Sinai, right? He goes up.
And then descends with,
and then
the,
he descends.
With the commandments, yeah.
St. Paul does the same thing, right? He talks about going up into the third heaven and then coming back down into his missionary. Christ mm-hmm. does the same thing. He goes up for the transfiguration, and then he comes down into his passion. There's this upward and downward movement in the spiritual life, and it just, but it's actually cycling you up, because once Eros, your natural love, is perfected through sanctifying grace, then you really see this in like St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, etc., that that erotic love to be satiated in God goes to higher planes, if you will. Gregory of Nyssa talks about Moses slipping into the bright darkness of God on the top of Mount Sinai, right? Which is just a beautiful, beautiful phrase. Dark. We forget that the scripture used darkness to describe God.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, especially in Moses's, you know, like the cloud descends and it's like you couldn't see anything up there, right? It was like
the
terrifying.
Psalmist will talk about that too.
Yeah.
So there is this upward and upward movement and downward movement. And I think that Pope Benedict points out. And then, you know, kind of, so what does this mean? Our relationship with God, does it have anything to do with our relationship with our neighbor, right? Because you think of like the, you know, the greatest commandment, right? Well, we kind of forget sometimes that Christ tells us to love our neighbor as
we love ourselves.
As ourselves.
Yeah.
And your self-love.
So there's a presupposition there that obviously you're going to love yourself.
Correct.
You're not just going to be this agape machine. It's like, no, I don't even love myself. All I do is love other people.
I think it's actually how people get spiritual burnout.
Because
they're not totally satisfied in God, and therefore they're giving love when they really need love in return. And we forget that their erotic love is for the saints is so deeply satiated, they can do these wonderful works and love their neighbor.
So climax, erotic love satiated in prayer life.
Right. So the seminal point is that if there's a right, you like that? There is an ascent and a descent, right, in the spiritual life.
Okay, I still have a lot of things I want to talk about. If you want the rest of this conversation, check us out on YouTube, the Catholic Man Show YouTube channel. We're on the Lord's team.
The winning side.
So raise your glass.
Cheers.
And cheers to Jesus.
That was great.
I wrote an article.
It's the best pun I've heard my whole life.
I wrote, well, it's...
I've lived for 33 years. Never heard a pun. That's good.
You're free to borrow it. I mean, I think that, I wrote this in defense of Eros for... You know, and then Adam and Richard sat me down and talked to me about like how we can't publish some of these phrases in the EOC, which is fine. It was a role reversal. So, but what I was great is that I talked about like seminal texts, completely made it through the edits. Like it just snuck right in there.
And did you do it on purpose?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Oh,
but I mean, it's a word though that already bears both meanings.
Okay. Right? So let's say you're a seaman.
Right. But Father Brian Ketterer joined us
in the Navy, of course,
and said that he really liked your article.
No, so that's kind.
Can you say that, you know, where can they find this article if they want to read some more?
Yeah, so Adams helps out with that. So it's on the Alcuin Institute website.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can go on there and they have a musings button. You can click the musings button and it breaks it down into essays, which is like a long form musings, short form, and then homilies. And so it's under essays. It's like 2,500 words.
If you go to alcuininstitute.org on the search bar, click Eros, type in Eros.
Right.
You will find it.
Maybe. Don't type it on Google, though.
There's not a whole lot of things. Yeah, be careful with Googling erotic love.
Definitely don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
That's, make sure your parental settings are on if you're going to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so like one of the things that the thing about this whole conversation that I think resonates the most with me as just like a regular person, is this idea of erotic love being something that moves me, like as a like a catalyst for movement towards God. Mm-hmm. Because to me, that explains a lot of the even like things I already assumed about Eros, you know, that like, oh, that it's just this erotic sexual love. Well, like, well, there's still like a movement. I can, right. you feel yourself being drawn to the beauty of a woman, and drawn in not just a visual way, but in like a complete way. It's, you know, when you're drawn, when you see a beautiful woman and you feel that, you know, like you're compelled towards her almost, it's not just like, oh, I want to sit and look at her.
Right.
No. You're drawn to her all the way. You know, all of you is being drawn to her, which I think is kind of the point of Eros, that you're all of you, every part of your being is made for this. And that's why I'm responding in this complete, like all of a sudden I have this desire to give myself completely to this thing, right, to this being that I've seen here. You know, I imagine this is exactly how Adam felt. When he saw Eve and said, "At last, bone of my bones."
Or Adam with Haley.
Or Adam Minahan. Yeah, like exactly. When he saw Haley. You know, so like Pamela and I, we do the Catholic Engaged Encounter retreats. And like one of the things we do at the very beginning as an icebreaker is we have each couple say like, what was the first thing that attracted you to your fiance? And none of them have the guts ever just to say like, look, I just thought she was hot.
Right.
You know, and like, I know for a fact, at least for all the men, I don't understand what it is about what it is in women that attracts them to us. Okay. Right. I know
there's not a lot.
I just don't get that, you know, but right. I know all the men in the room. It's like, well, I thought she was hot and I thought maybe I'll go talk to her, you know, and it's like, that's the truth, but none of them can say it.
Yeah. I think, yeah. And our tradition plays this out. I mean, if you think of some of the churches in Europe that we couldn't even build here because it'd be so scandalous, but like, the virtues are often shown as beautiful women.
Yeah.
Right? These mm-hmm. things that we long for, right? That the sight of a beautiful woman can awaken in you something that wasn't actually there before, right? Because this isn't like a beautiful statue or a painting or et cetera. All of a sudden, like, here's an ensouled, intelligent thing mm-hmm. that you just find beautiful. And it speaks, I think, particularly to the masculine heart. Dante, you know, Dante's writing at a time in which there's a lot of like courtly love poetry. And Dante's famous for turning this on its head. So Beatrice for him was like this, you know, childhood, basically not even a friend, just this childhood acquaintance that he had.
He saw like three times.
Yeah, that for some reason just enamored her. And she died early.
Enamored right? him.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Enamored him. And she died early. And so she becomes literally like his muse, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously the Divine Comedy is an example of that. But he writes some poetry too. And it's interesting in his poetry. It's like courtly love, right? He's talking about how beautiful she is and et cetera. But then he'll switch the pronouns and he'll say like, you know, your beauty, you know, was, you know, incomprehensible, et cetera. And it led me to his love. And Dante really plays this out, that the beauty of a woman can lead him to God. And our Catholic art plays that out. The Old Testament Lady of Wisdom plays that out. Boethius, right, talks about the Lady of Philosophy and Consolation of Philosophy, right? He contrasts her with Lady Fortune, right, which is a false allurement, right? And so there are these things within our tradition that point to this beauty unlocking something, particularly in the masculine soul, to rise, right? To go up the ladder.
And I can relate to this only, I mean, a little bit, just a tiny bit, in my own spiritual life, progressing, falling, you know, like more and more in love with Christ, having those moments in prayer where you just want to be like resting your head on his chest and just mm-hmm. like asking him just to hold you, you know? And there really is a good analogy. Well, it's not an analogy. It just is really happening. This idea of movement. Like, mm-hmm. I am being just drawn, almost, you know, like you fall in love with a woman, you fall in love with Christ. It's not the same, but you do, like,
right,
pursue him in that way where you want him. He's the object of my desire.
I think the Eucharist, I mean, you know, not wanting to scandalize too much, but I think the Eucharist is actually a deeply erotic act, right? Mm-hmm. I'm it's receptive.
You're eating,
right? You're receptive, yeah. Right?
He's literally becoming into my body,
right?
You know?
You're becoming one flesh of Jesus Christ. It's how you are saved, right? You have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And I think, yeah, if we're parsing out our own spiritualities, like as a deacon, you know, I'm still privileged to take of the chalice. And for me, for whatever reason, that act itself, right, to be inebriated, right, to be satiated in that blood, right, just to cover me. I grew up charismatic, and so there was a lot of, like, pleading the blood. Yeah, I grew up very charismatic.
That surprises me.
Like, Oral Roberts level.
No kidding.
You didn't know this?
Yeah. YouTube Harrison Garlick charismatic. No, I'm just kidding.
There I am with gold glitter running
just
around with my
slain
banner.
Slain in the spirit.
snakes. Right. There is a. I didn't get that far. There is actually a EWTN Catholics Come Home episode that I did a while back that actually talks about my progression that into that. Yeah, I did that when I was in law school.
Even in. About inebriating, there's that prayer that comes after Mass or after Communion. It's like,
I'm a Christian.
Yeah.
But it's sure. like, blood of Christ, inebriate me. Mm-hmm. And how you're like asking for that inebriation.
Well, I guess what I was leading to there is that, you know, when I grew up charismatic, we talked about pleading the blood a lot. And when I became Catholic, I really severed a lot of my previous spiritual habits, mainly because I distrusted them and I wanted to lean completely on the church. And so I was very pleased to find then, actually, in the condemnation of Martin Luther and that papal bull, it actually pleads the blood over the church. It talks about sprinkling the blood of Jesus over the church to help her, you know, from obviously this great depravity that she's suffering. So one thing, too, I think that's important to realize, because those who are familiar with the symposium will know that some of the symposium goes off the rails from our perspective, right, looking back at it now. And even from a natural standpoint of how it articulates this love, right? But Pope Benedict very clearly will talk about that one of the great things about Hebrew erotics, right? So you have like the Greek erotics and how to be skilled in erotics, but the Hebrew erotics is that in the story of Adam and Eve and then God using our common eros as an analog for our relationship with him, it makes it very clear that the telos, the end of common eros, is marriage. Right, which is not something you're actually going to find amongst the Greeks, right? They have this ladder, but that doesn't play out.
Marriage wasn't like that. Well, it wasn't obviously wasn't a sacrament for them, you know. And
well, yes.
And for them, marriage is like, okay, yeah, your wife. You know, for instance, like Aristotle, you couldn't even have a, you know, you couldn't reach the highest level of friendship with your spouse because she wasn't on the same level with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because Socrates will talk about...
Socrates,
like,
Aristotle.
Socrates will talk about, like, on that first kind of level of eros, your love, it's strictly limited, the common eros is particularly limited to man and wife, right? Because, male and female, because eros always seeks that which is immortal. And so there's a natural immortality that comes from marriage, which is your children.
Yeah.
Right. So your children lead you on. And so that's the fruit of that. Where I think he goes off the rails even on a natural level is that then when he goes up to the higher levels of virtue, honor, glory, etc., then in that level, you know, he makes room for homosexual relationships. Right, because it's too higher. It's men engaging in sexuality, which is seen as like a higher. So this is also some of the problem with Eros is that the principal pagan text on it is a symposium, which then when you read through that, because some of that homosexuality particularly is then contextualized in like a relationship between older men and younger men.
Yeah.
Right. It seems very scandalous. You're like, I can, this is a train wreck and I don't want anything out of it. But I think the issue we need to see is that a lot of our early church fathers, particularly from Neoplatonism, pulled a body from that train wreck, which was the pagan insight, this natural insight of Eros is the ascent, this ladder going up, is actually quite true. Mm-hmm. And they're seeing through a glass darkly, and so they're going to get some things wrong, clearly. But perfected by grace, you know, we can see that this ladder, and then perfected in Jacob's ladder, this movement of the soul, actually bears a lot of wisdom and a lot of guidance for the spiritual life.
So one thing that I want to make sure we get to before we wrap up is this idea of, with context of movement, the unmoved mover.
Oh, yeah.
And how does the unmoved mover, who never moves, move all things to himself?
Yeah.
So just talk. I don't know if that's a question, but just like talk about
that. Yeah, sometimes it's talked about that like Aristotle doesn't talk about Eros the way that Plato does. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you'll see that, you know, Aristotle's going to talk about the good, and he doesn't really talk about Eros as much. But in his metaphysics, he has to answer the question, you know, basically he comes to the point of how does the unmoved mover move all things if the unmoved mover does not move? Right? How does this actually work? And which is a legitimate question. And so when he does that, his answer is erotic love, right? That all things have this satiation. And it's actually not just, I mean, not to overly complicate it, but it's actually not just rational man, right? The rational animal.
Uh-huh.
You know, even in the pagan context, there's this understanding that all things in creation, right, are pining to get back to God and the One. And so I think you can actually draw some pretty clear lines between this pagan concept that there's this erotic love of creation seeking God, and then like things the psalmist says, right? Like, you know, cold and chill, bless the Lord, right? Trees and grass, bless the Lord.
Yeah.
Well, how do trees and grass bless the Lord?
I've never seen them bless the Lord.
Right. You know? So the idea here is that, you know, dolphins bless the Lord, right? He throws that in. The idea there is that how does a tree bless the Lord? Well, a tree blesses the Lord by actually fulfilling its telos, by being a tree.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that that's actually contextualized as eros, mm-hmm. right? That it has a natural movement to do what it's supposed to do. And in doing that, it's
perfect
actually,
obedience. Yeah.
It praises the creator.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be a consequentialist. Like, I'm not trying. Like,
Adam, just, you know.
Embrace it.
Yeah, just embrace it.
No, that's not what I'm. But for the guys who are saying, okay, this is kind of piggybacks exactly what you were talking about. So, and maybe throws in selfishly a little bit of peeper. I don't know. But the idea of okay, how do I cultivate mainly this erotic love that would lead me towards God?
Mm-hmm. And not just towards like hypersexuality.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So like this idea, does leisure play a role in this? Like does beauty play a role in this?
Leisure
like,
plays a role in everything.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Pieper's really good. So Pieper actually, when he talks about this in his essay, which is quite good, is he talks about it in almost existential terms, right? There's this existential satisfaction that we will have. So I think that, okay, so what does this mean for me and my spiritual life and et cetera? I think that in certain ways, G.K. Chesterton will talk about the guy knocking on the brothel doors looking for God.
Mm-hmm.
And that you need to understand that. So you need to understand that you can't put this all on your wife. And I think that's one practical thing, is that all of a sudden you're having marriage problems. Well, probably a lot of this is because you have unrealistic expectations of your spouse. They're not here to complete you. They can't complete you. You right. have an infinite thirst for happiness, right? This erotic thirst.
And she is not infinite.
And she's not infinite. And she's not going to do it. So I think on one practical basis is you have to change your expectations, right? A lot of just life in general is actually managing expectations. And I think being...
That is so true. Yeah. That is so true.
Well, keep going. For someone who's gone through a lot of transitions right now, I am.
But
trying.
Really, like,
that's my own mantra right now.
Managing expectations is right. like, if you want to have better relationships, work on that and you'll be way better off.
The best text on that is Father Balthazar, which was kind of this courtly wisdom Spanish priest. He has 300 maxims on.
Okay. So he's not like the other Balthazar.
No, not that one. Yeah.
Okay, because we're not a big fan of the other one.
Yeah, I'll table that. And so. He has like 300 maxims, and a lot of them are actually dealing with expectations.
Okay.
How do you deal with expectations around you? And also expectations that you set for yourself.
Yeah.
So, I just completely lost.
That's okay. Like growing, like,
practical.
Yeah, practical.
Practical things. Yeah. So, I mean, one thing is that, you know, we're all made to know, love, and serve God. And they happen in that order, right? We can't love something if we don't know it. And if we love something, then we're going to want to serve it. And so I think sometimes we downplay the role of knowledge in the spiritual life. And so one thing is just understanding what Eros is. And so if you actually then have an understanding, because you understand Eros, you understand your own human thirst, your own human appetites, and you can start to actually distinguish them and hopefully dissect them to a certain degree of like, well, what is okay to put on my spouse? What's not okay to put on my spouse? Or if I'm single, like, what are my expectations for my future spouse versus things I should be working on right now that can't be doing that? Also, I mean... You know, pornography is a meat grinder for your erotic imagination. I mean, it's just going to destroy it. And I cannot talk enough about just getting away from it. Because the reason it's so successful is because we have this erotic thing that needs to be satiated, and it gives you this like just endless thing of, well, it must be in sex. So here's this endless supply of sexuality, right?
And playing God, where I'm going to be like degraded, you know, like I place myself anyway.
Well, it's also one reason I think that a lot of people, when you talk about porn and addiction and et cetera, that they lose the satisfaction and have to become more and more grotesque over time.
Exactly.
And that's actually a perverted understanding of eros.
Right? Yeah, and it's also a natural consequence.
Right. So you have this lesser good and you're trying, or this lesser beauty, if we're going to talk about strictly in erotic terms. You have this lesser beauty that you're then distorting and corrupting and then trying to satiate in. So you have to realize that, one, you've got to get rid of that. It's ruining your erotic imagination. It's ruining your relationship with God. It's going to ruin your ability to ascend the ladder, right? Because, your imagination is incredibly important. If you're going to read Dante, if you're going to read Gregory of Nyssa, you're going to read any of the saints that talk about this moving up, if your brain is saturated on that, it's like a dull instrument.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain degree. So I think, you know, those things of managing the expectation. But I think a lot of people look at God as one who gives mandates, not one who satisfies.
Hmm.
And I think that's one thing to talk about with Eros is like, no, God is there actually to satiate you. He actually is infinite goodness. And this is also, I mean, you can jump to this quite quickly if you just ask people what heaven is, right? Because if they don't understand the beatific vision, they don't even sort of understand the end, then they don't understand like how they're going to be satiated in God. Mm-hmm. Then they don't understand how to seek it in this life either. Because I mean, you could.
They're not even contemplating the means.
Yeah, it's like, well, I have. Go ahead.
He says it all the time, like, you know, come to me and your joy will be full, like, you know, all the time.
Because we kind of forget that, like, you know, a divine mystical union with God in this life is available to the souls who seek Him, right?
In this life. Not just in the next one.
Because we talked about the natural happiness of, like, say, limbo, right?
Yeah.
But then there's a supernatural happiness, and we can have that, albeit imperfectly, but we can have it in this life as well. And this is what you see in these great saints, like St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, Gregory of Nyssa.
The mystics, I mean, in general.
And probably the greatest one, particularly for kind of getting this off the ground.
Mary.
Mary, as always. St. Bernard of Clairvaux. Right. I mean, he does a commentary on Song of Solomon's that just nails this.
Hmm.
It's perfect, right? And he becomes this fountainhead of kind of recapturing this in a lot of the Middle Ages. And then not to ruin too much, but this is integral to Dante. Because at the end of the day, when Dante is going to come up to the beatific vision, Beatrice fades away.
Hmm.
The beauty of the woman fades away.
Right. It just pales in comparison.
And who leads him to the beatific vision? St. Bernard of Clairvaux, right? This erotic, saint, right, is the one that actually can lead him to the beatific vision for him to understand it. So even in Dante, there's this ladder of moving up, right? The beauty of
you
the
just
woman
ruined it for me. I just want you to
it's
know
fine.
That.
It came out in the 1200s, so you can deal with it. Right?
watch the movie.
Right. I didn't come out in the 1200s,
right?
Okay.
You know, but for the sake of rounding off things for your readers or your listeners,
So my last question. And then I think we got to wrap this up, is that, like, we talked about this a little bit already, but I've always wondered, is there a, you know, the four Greek loves, you've got Eros, you've got Storge, you've got Agape, and then Philios. Is there a hierarchy? Because I have, like, gone back and forth, I've Google searched this, I've got nothing, but it always seems to me like there has to be, these can't all just be like, oh, on the same level here. Like, that's not the way love works. You grow in it. So it seems to me after this conversation that you start with Eros. Like this is, this is because it is very, like you said, it's a self-love.
Right.
So that's, it's a natural, it like meets you at the lowest level of humanity could experience or begin to experience a level of Eros.
Yeah. I think it's in certain ways first and last in the natural happiness. So when you have Eros and it moves you towards that. Right. Agape is clearly higher because it's a supernatural love.
Right.
Properly speaking. And it's the problem with agape too, is that going back to a previous conversation, Plato Socrates did not invent the term Eros. It existed already.
Yeah.
Just like St. Paul did not invent agape.
Okay. Right.
Right. He adopted agape to mean something. So that's another reason why some of these terms become conflated. But you have Eros as a natural one, and then agape, as we're understanding the Catholic tradition, is clearly higher, right? Well, then if you say, like, well, what about Philios, right? Like Philadelphia, right? This city of brotherly love. Then that really can't, you know, you could make an argument that there's a natural friendship, but it has to be informed by Eros. Because again, you love others the way you love yourself.
Yeah.
And even Aristotle gets that, right? What is the highest form of friendship? Right? You wish the good for your friend.
Right, yeah.
Well, you're not going to do that unless you wish the good for yourself.
It's not a friendship of utility or pleasure, which are, once again, erotic because they're self-loves. They're like, oh, what do I get out of this?
So I think it's a higher self-love, right, that brings to that friendship that because I love myself properly, then I can love my friend, right? So I think Eros certainly informs...
Yeah, you're right. It still is a self-love because you still delight in the other so much that you desire... Mm-hmm. They're good because that would bring you, in fact, more delight. Because they themselves are the delight.
Yeah, so friendship would be perfected by a higher form of Eros and then would ultimately be perfected by a higher form of agape. And then storge is, you know, sometimes people even leave it out because it's only love by analogy because it's like, I love the scotch. Right, it's like I love a thing, mm-hmm. and Aristotle actually talks about this isn't actually a true love because it's you know,
really
well you can't have like,
okay, so I've always heard it was like the love between family members or something.
It's usually contextualized as like the love between like a thing.
Okay,
right, and so for instance, like Aristotle will talk about like you can't have friendship with a wine, right? That's his example, or like
you'll
a horse,
play, you'll play yogurt, or
right, you know. Yeah, whatever your example is, simply because like you might wish it.
I don't love you.
You only wish it good because you want to consume it.
Yeah.
And then it does nothing for you. Like, it wishes nothing for you because it's an object. So sometimes storge gets left out. Sometimes you'll actually see the three loves as opposed to four.
Yeah. I know nothing. I just don't
Lewis
even
talks
know
about, well, I mean, I'm just going to present. Lewis will talk about the four loves. I think in Deus Caritas Est, he only actually, I'm going by memory, so please forgive me if I misremember. He actually talks about the three loves.
Okay.
And he actually talks about, you know, Eros, Agape, and Philios. Not storge.
Last question for real this time. Yes or no?
No.
Is there Eros in heaven?
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, because you would have to be, I mean, I say of course, and there's probably some like Thomas.
Because it seems like
right
there's
now.
Nowhere else to move. You've moved.
Well.
Where are you going?
Well.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, so Aaron or Adam and I actually had a lunch one time that dealt with this issue because at the Chancery we're a bunch of nerds and this is what we do over Mexican food.
This is what.
So did I bring up a good question?
So it is a good question. Yeah, so I would say
My wife has to pick up her parents from the airport. They're going to be late. She's going to be late. Is that what I'm inferring? Right.
Well, I think that so in certain ways I would say yes. I think I'm, to be fair, probably channeling more of the Eastern side of the church.
Okay.
That shows that, well, listen. You're,
I do that all the time.
You're being satiated in God, right?
Right.
That everyone agrees with that, right? Like,
sure.
So the beatific vision is a deeply erotic act. It's very intimate, right? So God, you don't have a phantasm of God. God actually enters your intellect as God himself.
Yeah.
Right, which is
and blows it up.
Right, and just incredibly unique.
Yeah.
And so obviously you have this just,
unique is a word for
right.
it.
Yeah. Well, it's unlike anything, right? That we have. Yeah. And
that was a unique experience. Right?
So I would do that again. So, you know, I think there is, on both sides, east and west, there's an Eros because you're being satiated.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
Yeah.
You're being satiated.
Okay.
Right. The question then is, so I would say yes, right? Because in certain ways, even more so, because that is the beatific vision. I'm not really like, how do I give that love back, right? It's actually, I'm just completely satiated in
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think why Adam laughed is because there's a distinction on our, so a lot of times the beatific vision is compared to like a cup, like being full, right? Or overflowing, but the size of cup can differ, right? So
yeah.
like the person can experience a beatific vision in a different way than like another person could or in greater and lesser ways.
Yeah.
Dante talks about this too. Aquinas talks about this, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so, but one of the questions is, does the cup always stay the same? Right. So when you satiate in God, are you just in this immediate infinite forever? Right. And that's where you are. Right. Or as you satiate, are you learning more about God? And then you're actually growing in that knowledge. Not to mean that there's not a false egalitarianism there,
yeah.
but are you growing in that? And so there are some differences between East and West on does your erotic love, your capacity for God, grow in the beatific vision in which we're all kind of expanding in our ability to do that, right? Obviously, always being overfilled because we can't, I mean, it's just a drop in the bucket.
Right.
But there's some different thoughts on that.
So we don't know.
Well, it depends. If you ask the Thomist, I think they're pretty set that the answer is no.
That there is no eros in heaven.
No, that there's no
growing. There's no growth.
Of, there's no growth of like a capacity.
But there is a sense of journeying like in heaven, right? I mean, that's what they said, we're
getting outside my ambit.
That's what they say on Catholic answers.
We'll answer it when we get to Paradiso. When we get to Paradiso, right. We'll answer the question.
We had to bring on Aaron Henderson, who we've already had on to debate, because he and I over Mexican food with the mediation of Adam had a somewhat of a debate on this.
All I know is that there is obediential potency in heaven.
Right. So Aaron at the Chancery gets all the obediential potency jokes, and I get all the eros jokes. Right.
Nice. Yeah. The downside is that there's probably a lot more eros jokes than there are obediential potency jokes.
Well, I think obediential potency, everyone's like, oh, haha, and then like the erotic like, love jokes. Like the people who don't means. Know what's happening are like, oh my gosh, what? What? Yeah. Like, sorry? Is your deacon's involved in erotic love?
Right. We were like, I didn't know what the obediential potency was, but I laughed because everyone else was laughing. But now
it's weird.
Now we're making sex jokes.
Yeah,
and
no one's scandalized by obediential potency.
Exactly.
So, yeah, people have hung eros signs on my door before at the Chancery, which has been fun.
That is hilarious.
On Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
It was epic.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good.
That
was
is good. That's very good.
And even people who didn't understand that I wrote an article on eros were like coming by and be like, that's a good joke. And I was like, wait, what do you think the joke is?
Yeah, but it's more personal.
Right.
Well, Deacon, thank you very much for joining us today. Again, you wrote this article.
Catholic Answers. And also, not Catholic Answers.
Not Catholic Answers, Alcuin Institute.
Alcuin Institute. Next week, yeah. Potentially Catholic Answers.
Yeah, we're working on that.
Are there any resources that you would... Okay, you said Deus Caritas Est.
Yeah, so if you... Anything else? Not to like plug this. I tend to like citations. So if you actually find the article on Alcuin Institute website, In Defense of Erotic Love... there's a lot of citations on that.
Okay.
And so you're going to deal Plato Symposium, Deus Caritas Est. I also rely on Joseph Pieper a lot. C.S. Lewis writes on this too. Because I think there has to be a certain appeal to authority. Because when you start doing something, when you talk about erotic love and people aren't familiar with it, the first question is, well, is this your own idea or is this from tradition?
Right.
And the answer is it's from tradition. And so it's a heavily cited article to kind of show how that works.
Very good.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
And you're going to be back on Talk About Hell.
Whenever you guys want me to. Eros and Hell. We got it.
All right. That's good. Thanks, Deacon. Right.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Hi, this is Bishop David Konderla of the Diocese of Tulsa in Oklahoma. So let us pray. Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, that never was it known that anyone who fled to thy protection implored thy help or sought thy intercession, was left unaided. Inspired with this confidence, I fly to thee, O Virgin of Virgins, my Mother. To thee do I come. Before thee I stand, sinful and sorrowful. O Mother of the Word incarnate, despise not my petitions, but in thy mercy hear and answer me. Amen.